Episode 17. Welcome to episode 17 of Thinking Habits Podcast. We're going to cover a couple of different things today, but I'm going to start straight off with this article that's just appeared in The Observer yesterday afternoon about the NHS mental health crisis worsening as 2,000 staff quit every month. A pledge to boost services undermined by a failure to retain thousands of key workers. A total of 23,686 mental health staff, not just staff, just mental health staff, left the NHS between June 2017 and the end of May this year, Health Minister Jackie Doyle Price told Labour MP Paula Sheriff last week. One in 10 mental health posts were unfilled at the end of June, and it is the equivalent of one in 8 of the sector's whole workforce left in the last year. Now, in July last year, the then Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt promised to increase mental health workforce by 21,000 staff, 19,000 of them in the NHS, and yet this hasn't happened. From my point of view, they slashed the NHS bursary, they got rid of that, so that made becoming a nurse and training to be a nurse incredibly difficult. I know that I could not have done my nurse training without the bursary, because unless you're doing the degree, you can't get student loans, or you couldn't at the time. You could only do it by the bursary, and at that point I was doing the diploma, and then I switched to the degree course in my final year. Now it's slightly different, but it puts people off.
Yeah, but you still had to work. You know, the bursary wasn't, it's not a huge amount of money that that people are being given, and slashing the bursary, it pushes people out. You know, there's so much noise made about, oh, committing to getting people from this disadvantaged backgrounds into training, in giving them access to university and different types of training in order to give them more opportunity, yet you immediately cut them out by saying, oh, but you can't have any money to do it with.
No.
I mean, is the fees bursary gone as well, or is it the... Because it was split into... When you did it, it was split into two, wasn't it? Your fees were covered, and then you got a small bursary to supposedly to live on, although...
No, I'm not 100% sure. But what I will say, what I do know is, even with the bursary, what people need to bear in mind is that a lot. There's been some commentary about, well, not all courses, you know, university courses get a bursary. No, they don't. But not all courses are full time shift work from the moment you start your course. I did a 50% educational placements, and then 50% vocational placements on hospital wards, and I had to work the full shift pattern, the full week. Nights, weekends, bank holidays, the whole lot, as part of my training.
You're essentially working as a nursing assistant.
I was working as a nursing assistant, essentially training. But at the same time, even though they advise you not to, because of the intensity and the pressure and the amount of work that goes into a nursing course, at the same time I was doing bank shift in my own time. So while I was training, I was not alone on the course. Nearly everybody I know was doing a 50, 60, 70 hour week sometimes, just to make ends meet in order to train to be a nurse. Now, you compare that with some other qualifications, not that I'm denigrating other forms of education. There's plenty of different courses which I genuinely love to do, but they are courses where you go in for 3, 4, 5 hours a week, and the rest of it is home study or, you know, self-directed study. A bursary is not just a handout. A bursary is helping you to live a functional life while working incredibly hard before you even got the qualification to be a nurse. And to take that away under the guise of austerity has absolutely, I mean, mathematically decimated mental health services. And at the same time, the services themselves are being cut. So you have mental health nurses or support workers or psychiatrists or doctors, the caseload that's going up by 20, 30, 40%. you have an increase in stress and pressure due to the financial problems and societal problems that we have currently, which is causing an increase in people developing mental health problems. Combining that with an increase in understanding of what mental health problems are means more people are seeking help. So you have an increase in people coming in and a deliberate and insidious cutting of the people who are there to help them, and it creates a perfect storm. You've got absolute chaos, and it's no exaggeration to say that this has cost lives. This has caused death. This has caused people to drop out of treatment, to deteriorate in their mental health, and people have died. And it's not just mental health services. It's across the whole gamut of public sector social care. These cuts are dangerous, and many mental health professionals, according to this article, are saying that understaffing is a key reason why so many people face lengthy NHS waits for treatment. Chris Hobson, the chief executive of NHS Providers, which represents trusts providing all types of NHS care, has warned that staff shortages mean mental health trusts cannot meet the rapidly rising demand for care. Fewer than a third of trust chairs and chief executives believe the government's plans will deliver enough staff. So Jeremy Hunt, his aim to increase NHS staffing by 21,000 staff resulted, 8 months after his pledge, in an increase of 915 people, which is nothing. We need 915 people in Manchester at least. So understaffing across the NHS as a whole is the worst it's ever been. A record 107,000 vacancies include a shortfall of 11,000 doctors, 41,700 nurses. The highest numbers ever. The King's Fund Health think tank said that staff shortages across the NHS were fast becoming a national emergency. It just makes me so angry. I mean, they're talking about a lot of the reasons why people are leaving. It's because people are understaffed. I had a caseload of 30. 30 was just about manageable for me when I worked in the prison. But it depends, because if you've got we had a caseload of 30 people with a variety of different conditions. So if I had a caseload of 30 people who had anxiety and depression across a sort of low level. Often we see people with adjustment anxiety from, you know, they've only just come in for the first time into prison.
So that should be fairly short term.
Yeah, you can manage those quite easily. But then when you start getting an increase in patients with paranoid schizophrenia, borderline personality disorder, schizoaffective disorder, early onset dementia, that means that your caseload starts becoming a lot more intense. There's a lot more interventions needed. There's a lot more intensive interactions required. So it's not just a matter of adding another five people to your caseload. You have to balance out the level of effort and the level of input that you need for each particular person. So cutting one nurse in 10 might save you some money in the short term, but then when you overload the remaining nurses with complex patients that one particular nurse was managing, that then reduces the effectiveness of the remaining 9, which then leads to an increase in work-related stress, people going off sick, people leaving the trust, people leaving the service. That's one of the reasons why I stopped frontline nursing. I mean, reflecting back a few years later, the prison was probably not the place that I should have started my nursing career. I kind of jumped in with both feet there. That's fine. We all learn from that. But the point is still the same. You can't keep cutting things and then expecting everybody else to pick up the slack and then hold your hands up and wonder in open mouth shock as to why everything's collapsing. It's just it just makes me so angry.
And by cutting the bursary, you're going to end up. It's all very well saying we'll increase numbers by 21,000, and obviously that hasn't happened, but it's, if you're not training new staff, people are going to be retiring. This is, on top of you've got your natural wastage,
yeah,
that was probably factored into these cuts. They probably said, oh, well, you know, people are going to be retiring and we won't replace them, which is incredibly short-sighted thinking, but it's the way a lot of things work when there's staffing cuts needed. Rather than have the cost of making people redundant,
yeah,
you allow some of it to happen, but you don't replace people when they retire or they move on. But by not having, by having fewer people training up, and it's not a profession that you can just walk into.
No,
it's even when, you know, even when you qualified, and even though you, the way your placements worked out, and you did a lot of what you found that you wanted to do, you did towards the end of your training.
Mm.
So you were, and you were already working with a view to what you wanted to do beyond qualification, beyond graduation. You were still learning when you...
I was still learning until the day until the day I left the prison, you know, until I stopped working. I still, you know, the whole point of continuous professional development is what keeps you on the nursing register. I still have to keep up my knowledge of current practice, my clinical skills. I have to keep them up to date and provide justification for that every 3 years, otherwise I'm not allowed to register as a nurse anymore. It's a constant, continuous process. And then you factor in all of this, and then you factor in all this, the Brexit shenanigans that's going on. Fewer nurses in the European Union are coming over here because they're terrified of what's going to happen. A lot of the nurses that we're seeing coming over here from Eastern Europe, who are just incredible nurses, incredible talent coming through, are going home again because they're like, well, I'm not welcome here anymore. You know, I've worked with a number of nurses when I was in Sheffield who, immediately after the Brexit vote, were subjected to all kinds of horrendous comments and stuff. Although, that, you know, this is that's not for this episode. I could go on, you know, at length about that in another episode. But it's a factor. People aren't being retained, not locally or Europe wide, and we're already struggling. We're already on our knees. If we can't tap into a pool of nurses from elsewhere because they don't want to come to the UK anymore, what are we going
to
do?
It's not just don't want to come as well. There's been nothing said about how nurses, and not just nurses, across a lot of people who were, have a professional qualification within the EU, at present it's quite easy for them to come and work in the UK and vice versa, you know. But there's been nothing said about what's going to happen. So in theory, within the next, I mean, how far was it, March 19th, the official, yeah, the, even though it's not actually going to happen then, but that's when it, if
so,
that's the official date,
yeah,
nothing's been said about how you'd go on from there. So people are going to be thinking, I know I would be thinking, well, why should I move my entire life to go and work somewhere where in six months time I might be having to make other plans.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, on top of that's before you even look at not being made to feel welcome.
No.
It's, you know, how many hurdles are going to be in the way of actually starting to,
yeah,
actually even starting to work in the first place. Mm.
Yeah. It's incredibly worrying. And then another article that I wanted to touch on today, which ties into it, because it talks about, you know, it's that Venn diagram of cuts and what it's done to people. There was a mass walkout by prison officers in protest at the condition in jails in England and Wales, and that has itself also affects, you know, the mental health of staff, the mental health of prisoners, the mental health of nurses in the prison. The level of the increase in violence and tension and stress in the prison services coming to a head. Something terrible is going to happen. It just feels, it's like a powder keg waiting to go off. David Gork, the Justice Secretary has said that these protests in could lead to an increase in violence rather than helping the crisis. His comments came up as the walkout, which began at 7 a.m. on Friday, was called off by the Prison Officers Association after talks with the prison minister. Now, Gawk said, "I do believe we have to take steps. I agree with those who say that the level of violence is unacceptably high, and we're determined to bring it down. I think the action does nothing to help the process, and locking up prisoners for 24 hours a day, which may be the consequences of what the POA are doing, only increases the risk of violence." Well, from my experience of working in the prison, that's absolute nonsense. First of all, they staged a walkout in between prisoner movements. They go out on their lunch break, they go out on in between activities to minimise that disruption, because it causes disruption for them as well as the prisoners. They know full well what they're doing in terms of making their protests.
Well, they're not protesting against the prisoners, are they?
No, they're not. And the, and also that statement is just knee-jerk fear-mongering. He has completely sidestepped the fact that prison officers don't protest very often at all. It has to be incredibly bad. I've seen horrendous conditions when violence erupts in prisons, and they just go in every day and they do their jobs. They do their jobs, and they do it to the best of their ability under incredibly trying circumstances. And the government will just turn on the POA and say, well, you shouldn't really be doing that because it's affecting the prisoners. The government don't give two shakes about prisoners. The government were going to take away the books and meaningful activities for prisoners without even consulting people about it, until there was such an outcry that they backtracked on it. And this statement about locking them up for 24 hours a day, it was the government's implementation of replacing knowledgeable, experienced prison officer staff with low-paid, low-grade, entry-level prison officers, reducing the numbers by at least 20% and forcing prisons to lock people up for at least 22 hours a day, which caused this problem in the first place. So turning it onto the prison officers who can't unlock prisoners when they need to, who haven't got the staff to manage the prison properly, who haven't got the facilities to be able to deal with stress, anxiety and mental health, who don't have access to proper services because the mental health provisions are being cut and slashed left, right and centre, to turn it back onto the prison officers and blame them for it is nothing short of absolutely shameful. It's disgusting. I'm just looking at some of the images, you know. I recognise some of the prison officers stood outside HMP Manchester. You know, I've worked with these people for several years, and you know, and they do a very, 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 very hard job. And these people stood outside for half an hour, registering their complaint, and then went through the security and then went into work and did their jobs. And that's what they always do. But you don't see that on the news. You don't see that from the Justice Minister. The Justice Minister wouldn't set foot in HMP Manchester when it was kicking off. You wouldn't see it. He has no idea what goes on. Absolutely none. Anyway, at the risk of turning this into a soapbox, I need to move on. It's
a worthy soapbox, nonetheless.
It's a worthy soapbox, but it just drives me mad. It makes me so upset. There's so many really good people leaving, and there's so many really good people who have ended up mentally and physically broken by this job, and they get that people just look down their noses at them, and it just drives me mad. It makes me so upset to see. It's a real shame. Anyway, you've had some good news.
Yes, I have. When I first spoke about MS and it was either just before or just after I'd had my nurse's appointment. I don't recall right now, but I don't know if I explained it to him. Normally, I would have one appointment every 6 months as a checkup. One of those appointments would be with the MS nurse. One appointment would be with part of the consultant team. So effectively, you see your consultant every 12 months and your nurse every 12 months.
Yeah.
And they alternate. So you're having an appointment every 6 months. Obviously, any problems in the meantime, you get an emergency appointment. Something had happened with my appointments. They'd all got mixed up from last year. So I hadn't actually had a nurse's appointment in quite a long time. And I saw a nurse at the beginning of August, and then I had a further appointment just this Monday with the consultant. When I saw the nurse, we spoke about medication, and I've been on Copaxone injections. I've been on Copaxone since June 2009, so 9 years on the same medication. Mm.
Do you want to go into a little bit about what Copaxone is?
Yeah, Copaxone is part of a group of medications called disease-modifying drugs, and they change the way the disease behaves in your body. So at the time when I first went on to disease modifying drugs, there were four available. Three of them were interferon beta, I think.
Yeah.
And they were originally, I think they were originally developed as cancer treatments, and they were treatment for hepatitis.
Alpha interferon beta.
And it changes the way, it's not an immune suppressant, but it changes the way MS can work in the body, or works in the body, is that your white cells can't differentiate between self and non-self. So they will attack your nervous system. They'll attack the myelin sheath that coats the nerves, and that's what causes the problem. It causes the inflammation. Put a disease modifying drug into the system, and they draw the cells attack that, so it forms like a barrier. So that's how that works. So it reduces the number of relapses. There's some evidence to suggest that it reduces the severity of relapses that you do have, but that's not what the drug's licensed on. It's licensed on reducing the number of relapses that you have. It's supposed to reduce them by about a third, and that's the same across all four of the drugs. So I mentioned that there's three that are interferon based. I started on one of those in January 2008, but I had to stop taking it in June. So I switched over to Copaxone, which is a drug called glatiramer acetate, and it works in the same way, but it has fewer side effects. The only reason I didn't go for it in the first place is because it was the only one that was every day injections, and that put me off.
Yeah.
As it turns out, Copaxone actually has fewer side effects. In some ways, it's a shame that I'm going to be changing from it, because there's very few side effects. The main side effect, which is the reason why I am stopping taking it, is that it destroys the subcutaneous fat layer. That's what you're injecting into. And with it being an acidic solution, you can get quite painful lumps under the skin. And you do get lipoatrophy, which is where the fatty layer breaks down, and it causes dents and dimples. And I've got that there's fewer and fewer rotation sites that I can inject into. And since they changed the formula
about 18 months ago.
Yeah, from, it used to be 20 milligrams daily injection, and that changed to 40 milligrams three times a week. I found the 40 milligram injections much more painful, and that's never really gone away. And I did ask about this and said, you know, is it just because it's a higher, I assume it's because it's a higher concentration, because the actual amount of liquid being injected, it hasn't changed. It's still 1 millilitre, but it's twice as strong. And the nurse consultant who I saw said, you know, officially it shouldn't be any more painful. However, anecdotally, a lot of patients have been reporting that it's more painful, and some people have even gone back to the daily injection because they just can't tolerate the
increased
the, the increased level of pain, and the I have noticed that it takes much longer for the injection sites to settle down.
Mm.
I've also been getting a lot more bruising, although that might be totally unrelated. Now, when I saw the nurse appointment at the beginning of August, I was told that not tolerating the injections as well anymore was one of the, you know, like qualifying, was qualifying grounds to change medication.
Mm. And also, even though you haven't been, you haven't had a major relapse for a little while, you have been having mini.
Yeah, I have.
Mini
yeah.
lapses
yeah.
as well, which suggests that you're not necessarily getting as much benefit from it as you used to.
Yeah, and it's, but that, it, so given that I could, I was eligible to change medications, I was looking at what I was, which drugs were open to me, because since I was first diagnosed and first went on to treatment, rather than being just the four drugs, there's been so many more medications approved, and originally there were, it was the new drugs that were approved were higher risk, much higher efficacy but much higher risk, and had worse side effects, and they were only available to highly a subset of relapsing remitting MS called highly active remitting MS, relapsing remitting, sorry. But in the meantime, there's many more drugs have been approved, and now I was directed to the MS Choices,
yeah.
was it called, which is on the MS Trust website, and it's basically, you look at the different drugs, you look at the, it shows you their average efficacy, and lists all the side effects, so you can basically compare what you're gaining. Now, they're given a sort of efficacy rating, and when I looked at it, there were two alternative drugs that were open to me, because we ruled out going back onto an interferon.
Mm.
Ruled that out straight away, because the three interferon drugs all have similar side effects,
yeah.
and I stopped taking it due to the side effects. Obviously, Copaxone is what I currently take, and there's two different tablets that I would currently be eligible for.
Mm-hmm.
And one has an efficacy rating of 1.25, and one has an efficacy rating of 1.2. And I will.
So what does that mean?
It's well, the one that I'm looking at, which is, or the one that I've selected, which is Tecfidera, reduces relapses by up to 50% in the first few years, but long-term effects on disability is uncertain. Obviously, it's quite,
it's quite new.
It's
it?
Quite yeah. a new drug, so there just isn't the data for that. Now that has the rating of 1.25. The other drug, which I can't remember what it's called,
I'll have a look.
Yeah,
a look
at that has a slightly worse side effects, and a rating of 1.2, and I think it's about 40 to 45% efficacy relapse reduction.
Hmm.
Sorry, so it's drug choices on the MS website. Sorry. So when I said I'd looked at the drugs, and when I went there on Monday, I said that I'd looked at what was available to me, and I was thinking definitely until I wanted to go with the drug called Tecfidera, which is tablets, so no more injections, yay. Although I will have, as part of the monitoring, I will need to have 3 monthly drug blood tests, so that's, you know, that's will take, you know, that's a different factor to think about, because obviously with as is often the case with a more effective drug, there's more side effects to consider. There's for about the first few months, a lot of people, it doesn't actually, I'm just scanning my letter here, it doesn't actually give me the numbers, but I was told a lot of, quite a lot of people who take this drug do get the initial side effects, which is flushing, nausea, abdominal pain, and diarrhea. A third of people, it does say, I'm sorry. So that's something to deal with. There's ways to kind of mitigate that, like making sure that you take it with food and have fatty foods, but good fats, obviously. Unfortunately, I've been told that having it with like fish, so like fatty fish, oily fish, is better than having it with chips.
Oh.
But I'm sure chips be all right occasionally.
Hide it in a chip.
Have it with crisps.
Yeah.
So there's a certain protocol to go through. So I've had my initial bloods done, and I will be having an MRI. Because the last MRI I had was about a year ago, and obviously things might have changed. They did think that it might be considered close enough to be able to take that, but they just need to. I think if you get a baseline measure, you can have something called a trace MRI, which is where you have
radioactive dye
injected, and it just lights everything up a bit better, makes the MRI clearer. So blood tests every 3 months, because it can affect your white cell count and it can affect your liver enzymes as well. So that's fairly similar to the, from what I recall, that's fairly similar to the monitoring I had to have for Rebif, because that can also affect liver function. Now, the side effects of having low white cell count, obviously more prone to infection. And I have had problems with my gums, which I've got some not very nice treatment coming up. And unfortunately, the low white cell count could leave me more prone to issues there. So that's something to consider and something to look forward to. And something else that has been, it ties in with something else that's been in the news recently, about vitamin D. As part of my battery of blood tests, I had my vitamin D levels checked, because living in the north of England and also having a chronic illness, I am prone to low vitamin D. And when you read about what vitamin D is and its effects on the body, it's called the, sometimes called the sunshine drug, because it's a vitamin that's created in the skin due to exposure to sunlight. Now, we've had a run of very good weather. It's not so much anymore, but we've had a run of very good weather recently, so I've been getting lots of vitamin D.
Mm-hmm.
But check the levels. Now, my levels, it came back and it's just listed as low at 42.2. I didn't know what that meant, but
well, your average levels should be between 40 and 80. So below 40, you should be, looking at it. Below 20, it's very low. You would be considered deficient. So you're on the low side. But given that you are undertaking therapies which will also affect that, that's probably too, it's too low for you. You shouldn't be that low.
And it's low considering we've just come out of a period of we've had a lot more sunlight in the past few months than, and I've certainly been exposed to a lot more sunlight than I would have been ordinarily. So recommended for my GP to prescribe some vitamin D supplements, because I know that one of the, there's various symptoms that you can get as a result of low vitamin D. Fatigue is one. It has been linked with MS for quite some time. It's not considered a direct cause, low vitamin D levels, but it's considered a contributing factor,
yeah.
Which is supported by evidence that the closer you get to the equator, the fewer cases you see of MS. In fact, around the equator, it's virtually unheard of. Mm. It's very rare. And the further north, and I would presume the further south you get.
Yeah, it's quite common in the far north, and you know, you see a lot of it in New Zealand by comparison.
Yeah,
the further down you go.
Yeah. But low vitamin D can also, it can affect your body's ability to absorb calcium, which is why quite often when you'll see calcium supplements, it's calcium and vitamin D.
Yeah.
And as we all know, low calcium can cause soft bones or brittle bones.
Yeah.
And being a female, I'm obviously more, a female over 30, I'm more, or over 35, I'm more prone to bone loss and subsequently osteoporosis. Having had to take steroids, that can damage your bones as well. Mm. So it's something that it's obviously important for me to monitor, important for everyone, but
it's just a perfect storm for you.
Yeah,
isn't it?
I've got an extra set of risk factors.
Yeah.
So summing that up, hopefully within the next few weeks I'll be not only starting my counselling, which I talked about last week, I'll be changing treatments. I've been told not to take any further deliveries of my Copaxone, and I've got 5 weeks worth of injections left, so hopefully that means within the next 4 weeks or so I'll be,
so you're counting down your injections
on tablets. Yeah,
the other medication you were offered was called Aubagio, terifluonamide, as opposed to Tecfidera, which is dimethyl fumarate. MS drugs on the MS Decisions website are split into three categories: moderately effective, category 1.1, more effective, 1.2, and highly effective, category 2.0. So currently you're on Copaxone and you have been on Rebif. Both of those fit into the first category, moderately effective. So does Aubagio, actually. That's also in the moderately effective, but there's lots of side effects in that particular drug. Hair thinning, nausea and diarrhea, increased level of liver enzymes. And that's common side effects in more than one person in 100. Whereas Tecfidera fits into the more effective category.
Yeah.
Side effects include flushing, GI upset, gastrointestinal upset, decrease in white blood cells, rash. Less common but more serious side effects are monitored in that. But the decision that you came to was obviously the side effects are similar, if not slightly less, than the ones for Aubagio.
Yeah.
But the drug itself is more effective. So it was kind of a no-brainer for you, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. There's one that we haven't talked about, one side effect that's very rare, less than one in 10,000. It's a brain condition called PML, and I'm not even going to try and... progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy.
Yeah.
Which is why it's shortened to PML. It's a rare but potentially fatal disorder. Now, it has to be mentioned because... they have to mention it because there were 5 cases over the during the testing period, and one of those people died. So, although it's now been given a less than 1 in 10,000 annual risk factor. And one thing that was explained to me is the surrounding factors of the people who had this condition. There were, out of the 5 cases, it's questionable whether 2 of those test subjects even had MS. So they shouldn't even have been on the testing programme.
Mm.
It doesn't appear that the blood levels were monitored adequately.
No.
And these all happened overseas. I think they happened in Europe.
Mm.
And it was there's a lot more to consider in terms of their health. There's a lot more to consider other than just they were given this drug and
they got
this disorder, because it's the mortality rate is 20%, but survivors have significant disability. So it is, you know, basically saying it is something to be aware of. As part of the funding requirement for this drug, you have to have your bloods taken every 3 months.
Mm.
So if you're the people, they said another factor that was spotted, the people who did get this disorder who were having their bloods monitored regularly, there were large swings each period, so it was going up and down a lot. So a slow decline of it is something to be aware of, but it's not necessarily concerning, because it could just be your body equalising to the new treatment.
Yeah.
It's if it's making large swings up and down, then that's something to consider, because you're at a much higher risk when it does dip.
Yeah. I think with all these medications, you know, you have to be mindful of the side effects, and they often err on the side of caution anyway.
Yeah.
And the checks and balances they put in place are designed to absolutely mitigate that as much as possible.
Yeah.
Aren't they? So.
Yeah, and I think it's any potential severe side effects, they can't not tell you.
No.
But I think there's been, you know, both times I've discussed it, they've gone to great lengths to explain that it's a very, very small risk, but it is still a risk. It is something to be aware of. But as you say, all the monitoring is to try and catch anything potentially concerning at an early stage as possible. And if I do find that I can't tolerate this, then I can always go back to Copaxone.
Yeah.
The consultant, I thought, she did explain that there are patients who've started this treatment and found that they can't tolerate it. The stomach upset's just been too much. But there's also people who've, you know, she told me about one patient who she'd seen who spent a day unable to get off the sofa, and it was Christmas, and had just said, right, that's it, I can't do any more. I'm coming off this, I'm going back to, she didn't say what the previous drug was, but I'm going back to that. And the next day she was fine and has been fine ever since. So there's potentially going to be some perseverance needed, and I'm just going to have to plan my time quite carefully, which I'm quite used to, but also be prepared to have to cancel at short notice on things.
Yeah, sometimes that you know, that's just something that you have to roll with the punches, really.
Yeah,
don't you?
Well, anyone can get flu or something.
But I think you know, it kind of rounds things off nicely, because what that shows is the treatment that you've been receiving shows how good the NHS can be when it works, and when things are right, and when you do have access to the things you need. So you know, it's not all doom and gloom. However, it's very hard not to think that it is all doom and gloom, given the amount of doom and gloom that's foisted upon the NHS at every turn. Really, it's sad, because it does show that when it works well.
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, they're very, very much fighting an uphill battle, but the people who are working within the system, you know, they're providing the best care that they can. It's certainly in my experience, and you know, it's almost there's some really good services, and the going back to being slightly, you know, political on it, going back to what we were saying earlier, but the government, they're very quick to put services down and say, well, this isn't good enough, it needs to be better. But they'll also look at services that are doing well and go, well, see, they're doing fine. They don't, this gets an excellent rating. You know, it's like, no, they're getting an excellent rating despite what you're doing.
Mm.
Another thing that's worth mentioning, we talked about getting great support from the medical team at Salford Royal, which is one of the main MS neurology centres for the North West, I think. People do come from all over, get referred there. There was a representative from the MS Society who was there basically hearing, taking questions and hearing people's concerns, pointing them in the right direction to be able to get further support, or who to talk to if there were any issues that they were unhappy with. There's a display of various leaflets giving information about what it's like to be newly diagnosed, who you can talk to, different literature you can look at, different websites. There's information about all the different medications available, and as well as the MS-specific drugs, there's information about different pain management drugs and others. There's things like mobility, where to get help on mobility issues, the continence issues, which can occur. Touch wood, it's something I haven't it's not something I've ever had to deal with, but it possibly could be. They were also giving out cards that the MS Society have produced, and it's, if you need to, you know, you can be in a situation where you're caught short and you need to go to, it can be a little bit embarrassing to go, excuse me, I've got a health condition. And you might not want to speak up about that. So they've produced little cards that you can go and just...
Oh, like the ones for Crohn's disease and stuff,
yeah,
like that.
Just, yeah, you just sort of hand it to someone and say, you know, can I use your bathroom? Because some like shops don't have to have public toilets. But if you're out and about and you can't necessarily go to a cafe, or they don't like you using them if you're a non-customer, it's just... It makes things a little bit easier if you've got a little card that you can just say, excuse me, I need to... It makes it a little bit less... Because I would imagine... It's not something I've ever had to do, but I would imagine it could make an uncomfortable situation into something fairly traumatic.
Yeah.
If you're having to explain to someone exactly why they should let you use their facilities.
Yeah.
But it was nice that there was a representative there and making sure that people, because it can just look like a wall of leaflets, and you go, oh, there were people asking specific questions. That, oh, you might find this one useful, or take these leaflets, and yeah, I thought that was quite nice that there was someone there, because it can be just a wall of information and you don't really know where to start. It
can be quite daunting, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice that we've finished on a positive note. So. Let's find out what happens with the tablets in a few weeks and see what the score is.
I mean, to me, my initial thought, obviously, if not, I might change my mind on this, but the potential common side effects, or not uncommon side effects, don't seem like anything unmanageable to me.
At this, on the face of it, possibly not, but you know, everybody's different.
Yeah, so yeah. It's certainly not something that I'm dreading, but you know, we'll see.
Yeah.
And you know, anything that improves the long term. I mean, it says the long term effect on disability is uncertain, but there's reports that it has a positive effect. It slows down the progression rate. So
yeah, so that's good.
Yeah, that's all good.
Absolutely. So lots of interesting episodes coming up. We've got some more sports and mental health issues coming up. We've got some more feedback on Pam's MS journey. We've got a couple of other people who have specific stories that they're looking forward to sharing with us, which is really exciting. As ever, if you've got any feedback or questions or comments about you know, mental health, all matters, thinking habits, long-term conditions, Any kind of questions or worries that you want to share with us, please do. It's podcasts@thinkinghabits.co.uk, and we'll be back next week with episode 18. So in the meantime, keep talking, and if you need to talk, you know where we are. Bye.
Bye.